Alrighty, good morning. Where do we begin? Let's begin with something hot off the press, like literally hot off the press, hot off the printing press, just while we're waiting for people to join here. If you have not played with 3D printing before, this is what it looks like when it comes off the printer. This came off like literally 2 minutes ago. It's still just a tiny bit warm. Now this is part, first of all, we'll pop it off. You just little flex, and then here we go. This is part of a 3D printed counting machine. Now these little bits here are going to hold magnets. I have not designed this. I have taken this off the internet and printed it. In fact, just while I'm doing this, I will drop the URL from printables.com here into the chat. Brennan's here. Morning, Brennan. Just getting ready to set off to work. Good morning. I was going to say it is a Saturday, but then what the hell am I doing every Saturday? Anywho, so these are the magnet holders for the 3D printed counting machine. And then all these other bits are like the body of the counting machine. And the bit that I'm most happy with the outcome of, but most frustrated with the process of, is the counting rings. So for those of you listening to this later on, I've got a, let's call it a 60 mil diameter ring in white with orange numbers. And if you have a look at the link that I just posted into the chat, you'll see that there'll be four rings and there's a little lever. And as you press the lever, the counter goes around and it goes for the tens and the hundreds and thousands. And it just looks really, really cool. It looks super cool. Like, watch the video of how they build it. It's like, how do you 3D print a counting machine? And the reason we're doing this is going to be part of the talk that we do at NDC Oslo. We, of course, being Elle, my 11-year-old daughter, and myself, and we're smashing through the content for that right now. I'll talk about how I do talks in a moment. Some people might be interested. But anyway, so this is going to be one of the things we build. And because the joy of 3D printing, as opposed to all the other code that we tend to write, the joy is that you get to produce something tactile that you can hold in your hand. We're just trying to create a bunch of cool things that we can hand out and people can pass around the audience. Hopefully they mostly come back in one piece or in the original number of pieces they're in, because there's a lot of pieces in this. So anyway, that's going really cool. Now, the frustration that I tweeted about, and just by chance, if anyone is on here and knows the answer, the bit that I'm holding in my hand is two different colors. So it's a white ring with orange numbers. Now, how do you print two different colors on a 3D printer? This is not painted. They're all filament. You can use a multi-material unit on the Prusa devices. So instead of having a filament that goes down into a hot end and that's it, you have a filament that goes into this selector that has five different filaments that goes into it. And the selector can go and grab a filament, it can pull it down, it can stuff it into the hot end, it can start melting it and printing 3D objects like this. And then when you want to change color, it pulls it back out and the selector goes along and it grabs the next filament and it pulls it down and it prints that. Sounds straightforward. Your challenge is that to print something like this little ring that I've got here, there are exactly 100 tool changes here. So on 100 different occasions, the printer needs to pull the old filament out, push it back up, grab the new filament, pull it down, and push it in to the hot end. The issue, those interested, g'day George, welcome from Austria. The issue is that when you pull the filament out, it's sitting there at 215 degrees in the hot end. This is PLA, for those interested. It pulls it out. Now imagine you got this piece of filament that's only a couple of mil wide, and you're pulling it out. What does the end of it look like? Well, it's not going to be like a perfectly cut off square thing. Something's going to happen with it. Anyway, it gets pulled out. And then the next one gets selected and pushed back in. But the last one, or the one being pushed back in, has also been pulled out at some point. So what does the end look like? And the problem I'm having is, for some reason, the orange filament, now maybe it's humidity or temperature or the age of the filament, is just a little bit bulgy and it's having trouble pushing it into the nozzle. So what happens for the 100 tool changes here, I must have had at least a dozen occasions where it couldn't push it back into the nozzle, and I had to go and chop the filament off and make a nice clean angle, and then it fed into the hot end. Glad we had this discussion. So that is my problem. So I now need to look at all the different retraction settings and things like that and try and figure out how to do this with the orange filament I have. Mind you, I have just thought, if I just go and buy more orange filament, because the other ones are working perfectly. So I think there's something about this one, the age of it or something. And then I could use that on a print that doesn't change colours, because it's only the changing that's a problem. Evening, Christian. Evening. Morning. So anyway, that's the 3D printing experience. I think this, in fact, I've got little bits and brackets and stuff all over my desk here. I think this is going to be a super, super cool model. Have a look at the one I just put in the chat. The video is like epic. Newsy says, did you try a different spool of orange filament? No, not yet. And the reason is, it's because I don't have a different spool of orange filament. Not in PLA. I've got a PETG sitting there that will print some of these parts. So the path of least resistance in terms of the actual work I have to put in is just to buy a new spool of orange filament, which I will use at one point in time, and just try that. And that would be a great test, except that means waiting several days. And I kind of want to figure out the problem. I want to solve it. You know, it's just, for better or worse, one of my traits is if there's a problem, I can't stop until I fix it, until I figure it out. Now, that said, this is printed absolutely beautifully. If I put that near my face so it's in focus, I've done this with a 0.25 millimeter nozzle, so a smaller nozzle for finer detail, and a 0.1 millimeter layer height. This, without having to fix the problems, is more than a 9-hour print, just to print that little thing, but it is beautiful. And I wanted to get this one just right, because this is the thing that you really look at when you run the counting machine. So anyway, I will actually think about just buying more filament and just going and printing other random shit until the filament arrives. But I do also want to try and fix the problem. We'll see. This is print the numbers in a different color. I thought about that too. But the reason I've done it in the classic Prusa orange is that there's some PETG bits I also need to print. So PETG, for the folks listening, is less brittle than PLA. It's got a little bit of flex in it. It's better for some of the moving parts here. I've got PETG in orange. I wanted to do it in orange because it's not like the talk that we're doing is a Prusa pimping session, but there's a lot of Prusa stuff in there. And I just wanted to use the classic orange color. And your suggestion is good in that it might immediately work around my problem, but it doesn't explain what the problem was or how to actually fix it properly. And that's the thing that's bugging me a bit. I just want to fix the damn problem. Anyway, stay tuned. I'll post some photos of that once the whole thing works out. All right, on to business. Sponsor this week is Report Your RI, who by this time needs no introduction. Scott Helms' brainchild from many years ago, going very much from strength to strength, particularly with the bits and pieces that support some of the PCI objectives, which many organizations are very interested in now. Guarding you from rogue JavaScript. Don't get pwned. No one wants to get pwned. We'll talk a lot about getting pwned today. Get real-time alerts and prevent breaches. Hashtag secure your site. Look, go and check it out if you haven't given it a go yet, particularly for things like content security policy reporting, but also the ScriptWatch stuff. The ScriptWatch, I've got to get Scott on one time, and he can explain it better than me. But a pretty important part of PCI DSS 4.0, which... I don't know if anyone sets out just really excited about doing PCI, but it's one of those things you kind of have to do if you're accepting payment cards. So go and check those guys out. Report Your RI. Big thanks to them for this week's sponsorship. Now, breaches, breaches, breaches. All right, let's go through two breaches, a Lufthansa prawn thing, and then two banks. Nice little breach bank sandwich. Now, of these breaches, and I want to actually go and grab some of my tweets from these, because I try and articulate a little bit more information there than what people would get otherwise. Maybe I was mentioning T2 last week, but for those not familiar with T2, T2 is a tea shop that is here in Australia. I believe it's also in NZ and Singapore. So not exactly what we'd call global, but they make a lot of really good tea. I have bought a lot of tea from T2. Charlotte believes she had an account with T2, not in this data breach, fortunately. But it's a very well-known brand. It's in a lot of big shopping centers. You go in there and it's like, they're just cool shops. They're really, really nice things, really nice product. Now, they appeared on a popular hacking forum, I keep referring to it as. They appeared in the Twitters, and I tried reaching out to them. This is not the week that we've just gone through, but the one before that, so we're doing more than a week ago. And I tried reaching out via their contact form, and I tried reaching out to someone in a, I don't want to name the person or say the exact role because people will figure it out, and then they'll know that this person ignored me when I contacted them. But someone who is definitely in a position who would be able to deal with this. And I didn't get a reply from either, which is very, very frustrating. But what I'm finding with these is that in terms of disclosure, it's almost easier just to wait until it's in the news. It sucks because I want to see the data going to have been found as early as possible and people learn about their exposure as early as possible. I also don't want to get sued. So we're trying to sort of play this balancing game of how do I get the data in promptly and do proper disclosure. Now, once it's in the press, and particularly once the press has reached out to the company to notify them, well, it's very, very much public domain information by then. So headline here from cyberdaily.au, T2 scolded by, good headline, T2 scolded by alleged data breach affecting more than 80,000 customers. Now, reporters will generally say alleged after I verify, and I find that those email addresses in the alleged breach are on the actual site. I think we can go from alleged to actual. So those email addresses do check out. Not massive, 80,000 customers, not huge. I was just thinking, it's been a long time since we've had a data breach of many tens of millions, let alone 100 million plus records. Feels like it's been ages. Anyway, 80,000. So that's gone in there. They're using Script, as in Script, the hashing algorithm to store the passwords, emails, names, phone numbers, dates of birth, genders, because apparently you need gender to buy tea for some reason. You need date of birth to buy tea. It bugs me that because it's, for me personally, gender not a particularly sensitive thing, but it is for some other people. Why would you need to collect that? For me, birthday, I wouldn't care were it not for the fact that that's regularly knowledge-based authentication data, static KBA at that. I don't care if people know how old I am. You know, I do care if there's a piece of data floating around, which then gives you a foothold into social engineering, my bank or my telco or something like that. Why they need to store that is just beyond me. And inevitably, it comes down to something like, well, we would like to send you an email on your birthday and give you a small discount on some tea. Thank you. Here's your data breach. So anyway, now what else did I say about that? Because there was an interesting observation in the structure of the data. Now, I often said, one of the really fascinating things about data breaches, and one of the reasons I really started getting into it, is it peels back the covers of what happens behind the scenes. So if you have ever written code before, then you, like me, have written some shitty code. You've taken some shortcuts, you've made some bad design decisions, but you often get to stuff all that down beneath the immediate veneer of the service. So, you know, you've got a website sitting on the top, oh, that looks nice. And then underneath there's some technical debt. Let's put it that way. So the fascinating thing about data breaches is that that takes the dirty laundry and it airs it. And it's not just the dirty laundry in terms of, let's say, the database structure or the code itself. Very often we don't see the code. We see the data. And it's only when you get fully pwned, Ashley Madison style, that things like the code itself get released as well. Now, what happened with T2, so look straight into that bright light and try and find my tweet. I'm just going to go back and find it. Where's my profile? Is that there are things in there which give you a bit of a sense of how this happened. And I'm speculating here, and unfortunately we can only speculate because to the best of my knowledge, we still haven't had a statement from T2 on what actually happened. So here's my thread here. I said, unfortunately, I couldn't get in touch with anyone at T2 before this hit the press. Okay, then the other things I already explained to you. I've said it's a small incident in normal breach scale terms and contains 669 megabytes of CSV and XML files covering customers and orders. The customer email addresses are confirmed as present on the site via a common enumeration vector, so very high confidence in the accuracy of the data, which is what I just said. Most noteworthy is the presence of two folders in the breach corpus. One is called Marcus Test Directory, and the other one is called Ricky. Now, I did go to LinkedIn and look for a Marcus at T2, and I did find someone in a technical capacity at T2 called Marcus. I didn't reach out to them because if I was to guess, I think Marcus is probably having a bad time at the moment. It feels like Marcus took a backup, doesn't it? For testing, because it's literally called Marcus Test. Both folders contain PII, including legitimate email addresses, long established and present in prior breaches, and files dated April 2021. Now, what I mean by this is that there are many times that we have all tested with data. And like, let's be honest, there are times we have all tested with production data if we've been doing this long enough. And you usually get away with it. Not Marcus. Allegedly. Allegedly not Marcus. It's named after him. What are the chances? Very often when you test with data, you have dummy data, you have generated email addresses. There's certainly been many alleged breaches out there that haven't been real data, and it's just been data purely for testing purposes. However, I've written before about how email addresses present in Have I Been Pwned, or rather their presence in Have I Been Pwned, can be a really good indicator of their legitimacy. And many of the email addresses in Marcus's test directory, and Ricky's, you don't get off the hook either, Ricky. Many of the email addresses in Marcus's and Ricky's test directories appeared in Have I Been Pwned in multiple data breaches going back multiple years. These are almost certainly not test email addresses. Now, production data in a test environment is, it's like the oldest trick in the book. Again, we're like, we have all done it in one capacity or another. You almost always get away with it, but that looks like what has happened here. So I've said on face value and without any clarifying statements from T2, it looks like production data in a test environment that got left exposed. That's the Occam's razor. Occam's razor being that the simplest explanation is usually the right one. And it's a breach vector we've seen so many times before. So business as usual in data breach land. Now, I still had not seen, let's do a Google for this together, because I eventually found a T2 statement that was made privately to someone, which I've shared. Nothing sensitive in there. If I search for T2 data breach, do we have a statement yet? Why didn't I just notice this? There's even a Bitdefender link here from 10 days ago. Did I know about that then? How far back does this go? I published this 5 days ago. Yeah, that's interesting. I don't think I'd noticed that they had shared this. I really need to crowdsource this better, don't I? When you find a news article about an alleged breach, let me know, because by that time we can actually do something with it. Let's see. What'd they say? It's by post a threat actor. Even credits another one of his colleagues for the hack. Credit to Double, without an E, for this breach, the post reads. Compromised data. Also including this post sample data, which appears to be an entry for single Australian customer. The data appears to be legitimate. Cyber Daily. So they're quoting Cyber Daily, which is the story that I found. Okay, cool. Okay. All right. So, yep. Same old stuff there. Now, here's T2's statement. Anyway, so this is the rabbit holes I often go down. So I'm doing this one thing and then I get distracted by that. And then you go down and down and down and down. And then you're like, what was I doing when I ended up over there? Not seeing anything else here about breach disclosure from them, not at a glance. There's actually, just to make things really confusing, there's a company called T2 Data that does cybersecurity. How about that? Anywho, so there's a statement here. This is obviously inside a private chat with someone where they've contacted T2 and gone, hey, like, what's happened to my data? And the message from T2 here said, hi, redacted name. Thanks for reaching out. T2 has recently become aware of unauthorized third-party access to a file containing T2, a lot more than one file, T2 customer details, which was hosted on a third-party storage platform. The breach included some customer information, but importantly, it did not include any banking or financial details. agree with that, but also importantly, it included people's passwords. T2's own systems were not breached or compromised. Their own systems were not breached or compromised, just the place where they put their data. Lacking a lot of clarification here. We are working with a team of cybersecurity experts to bolster our security controls to prevent incidents such as this happening in the future. We have reported the incident to the relevant authorities. T2 has deleted the password from your account as an additional precaution. Now, see, that's the thing. If they're rotating passwords, you kind of got to let people know. We would advise you to log into your customer account and request to change your password. The reset email will be delivered to your email address attached to your account, where you will have the opportunity to set a new password. Thank you for understanding, T2. Why is this not in a disclosure notice somewhere? And I'm quite sure they haven't sent disclosure notices because someone always sends me a copy of it when it goes out. So then I just feel like, I feel like T2 is going to get themselves into hot water over their disclosure of this. Time will tell. Okay. Daniel's tired. He could use some of that tea. Meanwhile, I've just knocked back my second coffee before 7:30 in the morning. Next data breach, Piping Rock. Now, Piping Rock is an interesting breach. Every time I look at this window, I'm looking straight into a key light. How do I move that? Let's hold the Windows key and do that. There we go. That's better. That's where all my things are. We'll look over that way. Straight into the other key light. Piping Rock. Piping Rock would appear to do some supplements, which is fine. Let me get the account up here. Have I been pwned? What's interesting about Piping Rock is that their data was posted to a popular hacking forum by Shopify Guy. Now, I've mentioned Shopify Guy once or twice the last couple of weeks, and this is the account that posted the Boat India data. It posted the, well, what was the Tiger one? Crunching Tiger or whatever it was, the Canadian one. And then it posted Le Slip Francais, the underwear place, the other day. And now this is the fourth one it's posted. And the speculation appears to be that they're getting some Shopify API keys from somewhere, and then they're grabbing the data and they're dumping it publicly. I have a bit of a sense that they might also be trying to shake down the organizations for money. Now, why do I say that? If I go to, what am I looking for? I'm going to go to this website where this data gets posted and we'll see if I can find, g'day Pim Doos, welcome, thank you for joining. We'll see if we can find this comment, but they made a comment on this forum post about the Shopify guy. Oh, it's Shopify guy. About Piping Rock. I keep going to say Piping Hot because is it still a surf brand? I have a recollection of that. Let's see. They say, today I've uploaded the Piping Rock Health Products database for you to download. Here's the data, 2.1 million email addresses. Right, so just underneath where they've published it, it says the management suddenly just stopped in the middle of negotiations. It reads like they've been shaking the company down for money, which is, I'm going to try and pick my words carefully here. Let's just talk about that bit. That's the face value of it, which is not unusual. Many criminal actors do this. Obviously, that hasn't worked, and the data's been published. Now, this is in the news as well. There is a story that I've linked through to from the tweet from Have I Been Pwned about Piping Rock. Every one of these Shopify breaches is the same JSON formatted data, and it's not exactly sensitive stuff by any stretch of the imagination either. Name, email address, phone number, physical address. It's not even, I keep saying all those reports saying orders. I'm trying to recall if there's the individual items that have been ordered there or just like the total value of things that have been paid for. But that's it. There's no passwords. There's also no financial data. There's not even your date of birth. Be that as it may, it's still bad news because you've still leaked millions of your customer email addresses out there. I have a sense, based on some of the other data I won't go into, that this might have been a discussion that was going on for some time. And on that basis, all sympathy to Piping Rock as well. Like, getting your data popped is bad enough, but then someone trying to shake you down for money as well, that would have to be an enormously stressful experience. But be that as it may, that data is now and have been pwned. It makes me wonder, if Shopify guy is shaking companies down for money, how many other things he is sitting on at present, which will then inevitably appear over time, and whether he's actually gotten paid out for any of these too. Some companies do pay. We see it happen with ransomware all the time. All right, so that's Piping Rock. That is the fourth in the series from Shopify Guy. G'day, Joel. Thank you for joining. Evening to you. Morning for me. Now, going back to that part of the world where it is evening, Lufthansa. This was kind of cool. Mostly cool until someone pointed out a little nuance. My mate Ken Munro from Pentest Partners tweeted me 2 days ago. He says, is this the best cyber pun yet? Surely only Troy Hunt himself could do better. Found a rather cool Lufthansa awareness cookbook. Now, I was going to say I've not flown Lufthansa for a long time, but I did. Only at Christmas. I did not see this cookbook, though. Ken might have had a better seat than me or a longer flight. So Lufthansa has got, it looks like a tongue-in-cheek cookbook. And it's literally titled, Have I Been Prawned? But then the R and the A are in brackets. So it's like pawned with the prawn in there. Recycling is not always a good idea. Hand on your heart, are you reusing one password for multiple websites or applications? You probably do, as do most people. It's normal, it's easy, but it's very risky too. And then they go in there and they talk about pwned passwords, which is really, really cool. So have I been pwned in a Lufthansa cookbook? And I'd imagine Ken sitting there eating his prawns, seeing that going, oh, I know that guy, that's funny. Now, because I don't pay attention to detail for stuff like this, I didn't realize until today when I got up and I was reading my tweets. At the end of it, it says, at Lufthansa Group, we recommend KeePass, which is already pre-installed on most devices. What? Nuts. Like, who has a device that had KeePass pre-installed on it? And this is not at all me being negative about KeePass because I'm a 1Password guy. It's not that at all. But short of browsers with native password managers, it is not normal for any of these password managers to be pre-installed on devices. So I'm not sure what Lufthansa is smoking there, but it's just a shame because everything else was so good until you got down to there. And I wouldn't even mind if they said, we recommend KeePass for whatever reason, but to say it's pre-installed on most devices. Because what's happening there, like you're sitting there on a Lufthansa flight eating your prawns and then I go, oh, I'm just going to pull out my phone then find KeePass. So yeah, it's in the App Store. You can go and get it from there, but it's not on your device unless you put it there. Now, Joel says maybe corporate devices. And I feel like he might be right there. And I think that might be the nuance that could be missing there. So just to extrapolate on what I think you mean, Joel, what if this content was targeted towards Lufthansa people? Or any pre-installed on most devices. But even then, there's a missing word, isn't there? Already pre-installed on most Lufthansa devices. Yeah, corporate mandate installed by IT. Look, I'd be very happy if there was a corporate mandate via IT to have any password manager installed on every device. I think that would be awesome. And of course, there are many companies that have that. But probably not CommBank, which leads us into the next thing. Mitch says, KeePass is a tasty cocktail sauce. Eh, maybe. It's a garnish. Now, CommBank is one of what we refer to as our big four Aussie banks. We have Commonwealth Bank, National Australia Bank, Westpac, and ANZ. We'll come back to ANZ in a moment as well. CommBank, from memory, is our biggest of the big four Aussie banks. And someone pinged me via email the other day and they said, how do I feel about banks telling people not to use password managers? And I was like, yeah, sounds shit. Like, that used to happen years ago. Fortunately, we don't do that anymore. Unless we do, in which case, let me know. And he actually pointed me to, I think it was some NCSC advice about password managers. And I was like, well, hang on a second. This says use a password manager. You know, do you have an actual bank saying don't use a password manager. And by this time, I'm thinking, well, clearly this doesn't happen. And then he's found CommBank. Now, evidently, CommBank is saying not to use a password manager. Now, I've got a whole section here around protecting your passwords. Passwords are the first line of defense when it comes to keeping your account safe. However, reusing a password multiple times makes it less secure. It only takes one breach to compromise all the accounts with the same password, so you should always make sure you use a unique password. So far, so good. Happy with this. Consider lengthening your password into passphrases, a string of three or four random words or an unpredictable sentence, and ask your staff to make sure they have strong, secure passwords. Now, there's a link here. I haven't checked this. Where does this go? I hope it's not just like letters and numbers. Let's see. It's another how to choose a safe password. A mix of letters, numbers, and symbols. Use as many characters as you can. Length. Avoid anything you can easily guess. Consider a passphrase, which is fine. Password security. Don't share your password with anyone. Don't write your passwords down anywhere. Make them unique. Now, what I always find fascinating here, and I have had this discussion with CISOs of banks before, including at least one big Aussie four bank I can think of. One big Aussie four? Big four Aussie. Yeah, you know what I mean. And the guidance around uniqueness, regardless of the type of account, is the heart of password strength. And I say the heart because one of the major things that stops is credential stuffing attacks, which we know are massive. Lists of sometimes billions of email address password pairs, and those credentials are used to try and access all of your things. If you have unique passwords, even terrible unique passwords, you know, one's the dog's name and one's the cat's name, whatever it may be, the credential stuffing attack goes away. Now, if you're targeted, well, then the weak password isn't particularly great, but credential stuffing attacks are not targeted. They are, as the term often is, spraying attacks. So uniqueness is awesome. Now, strength, if we have strength and we forget about what makes strength, letters, numbers, symbols, passphrases, if we have genuine strength and we have genuine uniqueness, you cannot remember them because you have hundreds of them. And if you don't think you have hundreds of them, you do, unless you're really, really, really young. But if you've been on the, let's say you've been on the internet for a decade, which if you listen to this, you probably have been because you all start out on the internet now and you're kids anyway. You're going to have more passwords than you can ever remember. Ergo, we need the password manager. You cannot have strong, unique passwords consistently without a password manager. Which brings us to the next paragraph from CommBank. If you think you can remember multiple passwords, let me rephrase that. If you don't think you can remember multiple passwords, the Australian Cybersecurity Centre suggests using a password manager. These tools can help you generate and store passwords for your less critical services. And this is where the rails or the train goes off the rails. Make sure you're not storing passwords for critical accounts such as internet banking and that your password manager is itself protected with a long, unique passphrase that you can remember. And they keep kind of oscillating here. It's like password managers are good for helping you remember strong passwords. Don't use it for things that are important. It's dumb advice. It's really, really dumb advice. Now, I did tweet this publicly. I do know people at CommBank, and I am going to ping them and see if we can get this fixed because this is just stupid, profoundly stupid. Why can't you just use the pre-installed KeePass on your device and just put your passwords in there? That's annoying. And I guess the annoying thing here is that you expect more of a bank. And this is the paradox that will also then lead us into the next bit around ANZ. Like, you expect more of a bank because it holds money. Every time we see data breach disclosure notices, such as T2, which are like, hey, your password and your date of birth and your gender got popped, but good news, your bank details are okay. We expect banks to better protect our things and to be the bastions of high levels of security. Now, I wrote a blog post many, many years ago about bank-grade security. And many funny things happened as a result of this. 4th of May, 2015, I said, do you really want bank-grade security in your SSL? Here's how Aussie banks fare. And I went through all of our major banks and I used the SSL Labs test, which should rank them from an A through to an F. I think they also have an A+. in terms of do they still support that? Remember the era this was in, right? So this is 9 years ago now. Do they still support SSL3? Do they still support SHA-1 hashes on the signatures? Do they have TLS 1.2 support? Do they support RC4? Do they have forward secrecy support? Are they subject to the Poodle vulnerability, which from memory largely boiled back down to if they still supported SSL3 rather than newer TLS variants? And some of the banks did terrible, like F grades. Now, inevitably, they did this for backward compatibility, but it was a really, really bad look. And the point I was trying to make is that when we use the heading bank grade security, it implies the highest standards of security. When in reality, whether it's telling people not to use a password manager or using weak implementations of SSL, as a lot of it was at the time, that's not necessarily the case. Now, fun side note, one of the banks that scored an F on this, later on, someone responsible for security there came to me at a conference and said, thanks very much for writing this. This was the leverage we needed in order to go and do this properly, because we couldn't get the funding to go and make the changes necessary. But once our bank was up there on your blog getting an F grade, suddenly marketing cared. So that's nice to know. You know, like it's not like I run some sort of protection racket here, but it was nice to have that happen. So CommBank is definitely on the wrong side of things there. Now, that then leads us into ANZ and something that happened just yesterday on the Twitters, which of course I shared. Daniel says, I wonder if that bank's website restricts copy-paste that can prevent use of password managers. Yeah, good question. Pinders, I can absolutely generate strong passwords like Spring 2024 with an exclamation mark. Yeah, bad news. Bad news. Now, the ANZ one, which is another one of our big four Aussie banks, someone looped me into this thread. So someone here, Conrad, has tweeted at ANZ, why are you forcing me to change my password without prior notice when I try to log into internet banking? I shouldn't have to do this unplanned. ANZ has said, hi, Conrad, thanks for reaching out. To help keep banking safe and secure, you'll be prompted to reset your password after you've logged in. You'll be prompted to reset your password every 12 months. Thanks for your patience, Conrad. It's just really bad. And Conrad's not having any of this. This is really bad practice not to give me advance notice in writing and a chance to plan a password change. I'm not sure. He's an IT professor. Okay, right. So he probably gives this stuff some thought. ANZ's like, we understand. Please don't hesitate to provide your feedback via the link to the complaint form. So anyway, I have chimed in on this and I thought I'd share that just for fun. And I've linked through to the piece I wrote. How long ago was this? Was it 2017? This was sort of the genesis. It was 2017, July 2017, the genesis for Pwn Passwords. I wrote this blog post, which I think is one of my seminal blog posts, Passwords Evolved, Authentication Guidance for the Modern Era. Or Senate authentication guidance for the modern era. And this went and took findings from NIST, the NCSC. I think there's some NCA stuff in there as well, about how we should be doing passwords today. And this was very sort of modern evidence-based security guidance for humans. There are things like we need to stop doing arbitrary password complexity criteria because it leads people to very predictable patterns. And every time I do this talk in front of a live audience and I'll go, yeah, you go to a website and you're trying to use that same shitty lowercase six character password as you do everywhere, and the website demands an uppercase character, what do you do? And then everyone kind of looks around nervously, and then someone's like, you capitalize the first letter, and then everyone starts laughing really nervously because they're like, holy crap, they've all just figured it out. That's my structure, my pattern gone. I've burned that. I need to go and change all my passwords. What do you do when you need a number? You add a one at the end. What do you need? Or what do you do when you need to have a non-alphanumeric where you add an exclamation mark at the end? And everyone laughs because it's funny because we all do it. And then you say, what happens in 90 days? And you have to change it. And everyone goes, oh, you just change the number at the end. So all of this security theater is a remnant of a bygone era. And it was very, very evident in 2017, 7 years ago now, that this is no longer something that we should be doing. The mandated rotation is one of the things that has driven us all nuts before if we worked in a corporate environment. I certainly had to do that every 90 days at Pfizer, and I always, always changed the number at the end. Now, there's a bit of guidance in here from, I think this one is the NCSC, where is it? One of the headings I have here, do not mandate regular password changes. Now, this is the guidance from the NCSC, and it says only ask users to change their password on indication of suspicion or compromise. Now, there are many reasons why this guidance changed, because back in the day, we used to say, what this helps protect against is if a password is captured somewhere, then it has a limited lifespan, which is a maximum of 90 days. If it's stored in a log somewhere, if someone sniffs it on the wire or something to that effect, you know, we can make sure that that is invalidated and it's no longer useful. Now, the problem is, you're a hacker, hypothetically, and you find the log with the password, and the password is Troy Hunt Pfizer 17. And you go, oh, I wonder. Troy Hunt Pfizer 17 doesn't work. Troy Hunt Pfizer 18. Oh, yeah, it works. Yeah, you know, what are the chances? Because this is what the humans do. So the actual practical benefit of it was always, always very questionable outside of password spraying attacks, again, which are very automated and does the thing work and there's no more intelligence to it. But the environment changed as well. And a lot of what NIST was saying here is that in this era of 2017, we were getting towards near ubiquitous transport layer encryption. So if we've got transport layer encryption, not just on the external networks, but on the internal networks, and that's now a big part of every organization's network infrastructure, that risk is now different to what it was back in the day. We've got lots of things like two-factor authentication. We've got universal behavioral user behavioral analytics, UBA sort of things, where we can see anomalous behavior. There's lots of other controls that we now have that we didn't have before. And the thing that we were using before to try and make a safe password actually wasn't very good because humans are not random number generators. So we chucked that out. And to have ANZ now go for your security. What's always fun? It's nice when there's support on the public timeline. Let's do a little Twitter search here. We're still calling it Twitter. I've decided that. From ANZ_AU password. Let's just see. Latest. That was the one to Conrad. And a banking password, so they pass this on to a team for you. Oh, wow, that goes back to 2002. Unless there's something flaky with the searches here, maybe they're not actually tweeting much publicly about that, but clearly they have a policy because they're rotating your passwords. Now, just to add to that, there's another blog post I wrote about banks, bank PIN. This was more recent, 2019. Banks, arbitrary password restrictions, and why they don't matter. And the bottom line here was that people would complain that banks had some pretty shitty password policies. Now, my mouse is just frozen, or that browser window is just frozen. All my browser windows have just frozen. But, oh shit, that one's frozen too. Well, hopefully, OBS is still broadcasting, but otherwise everything at the moment seems, oh, you know what I can do? I can open my iPad and see if I'm still broadcasting. But every single other window is just frozen up. Wow, that's a great look, Troy. Is it still live? Oh, yep. Okay. All right, I can start. I'm here. It's just that over there on the PC, everything looks broken. Okay, so I'll keep going. The fascinating thing with this guidance is that as shitty as it is on the surface, banks do an enormous amount of validation of identity behind the scenes. And I can't scroll down this blog post at the moment because my browser's completely locked up. However, what it says is I was having a chat, I think it was to the CISO I mentioned before, at one of these big four banks, when I was doing a talk at the bank. And we were talking about these arbitrary restrictions, and I just recall him kind of laughing, going, you know how much like identity validation goes on behind the scenes beyond just the username and the password? Like it's massive. And I think just as perhaps a bit of a litmus test on that, oh, my browser's just woken up again. A little litmus test on that is have a look at how many account takeover attacks we see on bank accounts versus social media accounts by, say, brute forcing the password. We definitely see social engineering from people where things like OTPs get socially engineered out and people get into accounts, or passwords and things get socially engineered out, but we don't see the same level of credential stuffing attacks, for example, because there's a lot more intelligence there. However, it's a really, really bad look. And the original tweet here, now that my browser's woken up again, from Peter, he says, my bank tells me that their exactly 5-digit password policy is secure, in the absolute sense, since it has a 1.5 billion permutations and the account gets blocked after 3 attempts. This just feels wrong, but I can't come up with a strong argument against it. Any thoughts, Troy Hunt? And that, yeah, that then led to the blog post. So the point is, by any reasonable measure, the banks are very secure. I think that's probably the words I'm looking for. But it's a bad look. The optics are bad. And I'd really like to see banks on the veneer of their account registration, login and change password pages and everything look as strong as the social media sites, because that should be the bar, right? It's not bank grade security. It's like, I want like Facebook level security. And there's still lots of account takeovers there. James says, I'm still trying to get Dumpster5, formerly known as Twitter, to catch on. It's just become weird, hasn't it? And it's a shame, because I feel like a couple of years ago, it was a much more productive environment. And I'm honestly blaming Elon less for that and more for people going, we want to leave here because we don't like Elon. And then, you know, there's a bunch of stuff on Mastodon, but it's never, it's always like a niche of InfoSec that doesn't have the breadth of people from before. And I don't know. It's a shame. It's quieter there. Joel says, question is whether Troy can stop the stream at the end. Well, I should be able to, because it's being broadcast from OBS, and also now my browser's woken up. So it should be fine. We'll see. Joel's like 24 hours of Troy. You can just sit here and watch me work the codes and build my 3D printing things today. But with that said, we have covered off everything for today. So being a Saturday morning here, I think I'm going to go out and enjoy the late autumn sunshine that we have here on the Gold Coast. Thanks very much for watching. I'll come back to you next week. We might see maybe more data breaches. We'll definitely see more data breaches. Cheers, folks. See you later.